When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
To listen without ads, head over to patreon.com/rightandwrong.
Ooh, a spicy question. I love it.
Because the writing is sort of everything, right? Like, you kind of can fix plot holes, but if the writing is
so some readers love that, and some readers are like, but I wanted more of this. So it's kind of a gamble.
Hello, and welcome back to the Right and Wrong podcast. Joining me today is an author whose first novel was published back in 2011, and since then has gone on to publish five more, leading up to her latest release, One of the Good Guys, which came out at the start of the year. It's Araminta Hall. Hello, welcome.
Hello, thanks for having me.
You're very welcome. Let's kick things off with the brand new, exciting book. It's been out for a few weeks now, One of the Good Guys. Tell us a little bit about it.
Well, it is basically the story of a man who relocates to a very remote stretch of coast in southern England because he has he's sort of trying to recover from the breakdown of his marriage, and he's really nursing a broken heart, and he just cannot understand what went wrong because he sort of was everything that women say they want. You know, he wasn't likely to be found down the pub getting drunk, and he wasn't, you know, he was always sort of, he was happy. He really wanted kids. He was happy. He did all the domestic things in the house. He just sort of thought he was like the man that women want. And then when he gets there, he meets this artist who is living on the edge of the cliff, about a 15-minute walk from his house. And she lives in this like falling down cottage on the edge of this eroding cliff. And they sort of start to form this friendship. And he thinks that she maybe has some sort of secret to life that he doesn't know about. But then meanwhile, there are two young women are doing a coast-to-coast walk, and they're walking for charity, and they're protesting male violence against women. And they're getting closer and closer to Cole and Lenny. And when they reach them, they camp really near both of their houses overnight, and they just disappear, completely disappear into thin air. And as happens with, when a certain type of woman goes missing, it becomes like this media frenzy, and Cole becomes a suspect. And the story sort of unravels from there.
Wow. Very, very dramatic.
Yeah.
I feel like there's sort of multiple things going on here. What's the kind of the first inspiration for this, the kind of core idea that you wanted to explore?
I mean, like, yeah, I always, when I write, I always start with a theme, really, or like, I don't think of it as a theme at the time, but it's like, an initial sort of idea sparks. And I was really, all my books are really concerned with gender politics, basically. And, you know, I've been thinking about it for a really, really long time and writing about it for a really long time. And I think, like, when Me Too happened, I had that sort of crazy sense of optimism that a lot of women had, that things were really going to change. And then in the past few years, I've just noticed this sort of growing feeling of anger and disillusionment among me and my female friends. And like, I couldn't put my finger on it because, you know, laws have changed. And, you know, I mean, you know, when I was a young woman, it was perfectly acceptable for men to touch you or make comments to you, or, you know, it was just something we had to put up with. And, you know, when my mum was growing up, you had to sort of physically run away from people, you know, all the time. And I felt like, oh, things have changed. You know, that's not acceptable anymore. I'm not really sure, like, why do I still feel angry? And then there's this walk I do near, it's about a 40-minute drive from my house. I live in Brighton. And you can get to this incredibly remote stretch of cliff quite easily. Well, I went, and it's a walk that I've always loved to do. Done it with my kids and, you know, my husband loads. And I did it one day, and there were these little Coast Guard cottages on it. And every time I walk past them, I'm always struck by how isolated they are, and how if I was living there alone, how terrified I would be at night. And I sort of always have that thought. And I've always thought to myself, I would love to set a book here. You know, it's such an atmospheric setting. But anyway, I did this walk one day, and I came home, and that night I was going out in Brighton, and I walked home alone at sort of 10 o'clock at night. And I live very centrally in Brighton, and I, you know, I don't have to walk really anywhere dodgy to get home. It was a quick walk, but I felt scared, you know, and I turned onto a road, and there was a man behind me, but he, you know, very quickly crossed the road and overtook me. You know, I didn't feel in any danger from him. But what I realized was that whenever I'm out and about after dark, or even in the middle of the countryside in the day, if I'm on my own, I do feel this little sort of frisson of fear in the back of my mind. And then it made me realize why I felt angry, because I was like, actually, we can change laws, we can change perceptions, but until we feel safe on our streets, it is, or anywhere, you know, sort of feeling safe felt like sort of the ultimate expression of equality to me. And of course, that is not confined to gender. That's, you know, sexuality or race, or, you know, it can be religion in some parts of the world. So it just made me think, we've got so far to go. And, you know, we've sort of been told, I mean, obviously, I can only write from the perspective of a woman. And we've been told that we have, we've come so far as women. And in some ways that's true, but actually there's so far to go and so few of us feel safe. And it just struck me that actually that sort of little threat of violence that hangs over all of us, so often is incredibly disabling. So yeah, that was that sort of, it's a very long-winded answer for telling you the sort of the genesis of the book.
No, that's great. I mean, that really kind of it really highlights what you are talking about, the kind of things that you are discussing and exploring within the book, beyond the fact that it is obviously a thriller, and there's going to be no twists and turns within that.
Absolutely.
Speaking of thrillers, this is your sixth book.
Yeah.
Am I right in thinking all of them are thrillers?
Yeah, I'd say. I mean, I think so. I find genres so difficult. Yeah. I mean, I think every writer will always say, you know, when they write their first novel, they're not thinking about genre. And I think that's because as readers, we don't think about genre really. So, I mean, I certainly don't. As a reader, I don't think, oh, I only want to read thrillers. I mean, obviously, I read loads of thrillers, but I also read loads of other types of books. So I'm like, so I feel like obviously the more enmeshed in this as a job I've become, the more aware I've become of the idea of twists and, you know, beats and, you know, what's expected of the genre that I write in. So I would say my last four books have most definitely been thrillers. And my first two, I think, are a little bit more woolly.
That's so true, because I've had a number of authors on here, often debuts or authors talking about their debut.
Yeah.
And I'll say, oh, so is this the genre? And they'll say, that's what the marketing team told me it was. It's like,
yeah.
Publishing
is a business like anything else.
Yeah.
And so, you know, we fit into categories and that's fine. And actually, I think also when you start thinking about what you're writing, when I was growing up, or still now, I absolutely adored reading Patricia Highsmith novels. And I had never thought of her as a thriller writer or a crime writer. But it's no surprise to me that those are the books that I like to write, you know, because I've always loved those books that combine, a really good story with something to actually say as well. So, and thrillers, I think, sit so brilliantly in that ground.
Yes. Yeah, no, I completely agree. And there's thrillers are usually, obviously you can have like sci-fi or fantasy and kind of merge genres, but thrillers are usually grounded in a sort of real life setting.
Absolutely. I think that's especially what the type, sort of the subgenre which I write in, which is, you know, psychological thrillers. I think that's what all of those writers, I think, know so well that, you know, the most scary thing is when you're, your just normal everyday life is disrupted. And, you know, and how everyday life can be the most scary thing, and how often, you know, like our brains are way more scary than a massive car chase or something like that. So, yeah, it's totally grounded in the everyday.
So true. I mean, you take it even to like the most minor thing, you know, you have like an appointment or something at a certain time on a certain day, and for some reason you're dreading it, and then you get there. Like the dentist is a great example. A lot of people dread the dentist, and then they get there and they're like, oh, that was fine actually, but in my head I made it so much worse than it was going to be.
Exactly. I mean, that is basically the definition of suspense. It is that thing of, you know, it's, you know, suspense is all in the anticipation of something happening, basically. So, and I think that's what thrillers do. You know, they take the idea that something has happened or something is going to happen that is going to really affect or has really affected your main character. And, you know, they pull you towards it sort of thing and tease out. I mean, that's the thing. Thrillers are all about the why, not the who, you know. So, you know, I think in a lot of thrillers, obviously there is a who involved, but it's normally why the person has done what they've done.
Yes. That's the, even if it's like a twist kind of reveal situation, it's more interesting. It's like, oh, it was that person. That's your brain kind of goes, oh, that's not what I expected. But then the why is like, oh, that's the kind of like, oh my God moment. Yeah, totally true.
No, I think that's why with most thrillers, we know the perpetrator as well as we know the victim, for want of better words. And so whereas in crime novels, you could have a whole crime novel where you haven't met the perpetrator so much, you know. So, and that's fine. You know, it's a totally different thing. Crime is much more about solving clues, whereas thrillers are much more about getting into the mind of someone who's done something.
That's a really good, I'd not thought too much about like kind of identifying factors of those two things. That's a really good way of kind of separating those two genres. I like that. So as I mentioned, sixth book, lots of thrillers. While you're writing, you know, I'm going to assume you're already working on something new, but while you're writing, are you conscious of kind of what you've written previously and not retreading this kind of similar story beats and characters?
Yeah, I mean, definitely. I mean, I think actually whatever genre you're writing in, most writers have a theme. Like, I think that... I think books without a theme, funnily, this sounds like name dropping, but I was in America, I'm published by Gillian Flynn. And it's a big publishing company, and Gillian Flynn has an imprint. You know, obviously she wrote Gone Girl, which is probably the best known thriller of all time. And so I've just done a few events with her in America, and we were discussing this, and she was saying that novels without a theme, you can always tell and they fall flat. And she was like, thrillers especially. She was like, if you don't know, she was like, you can have the most intricate plot that you've ever constructed, but if you don't have a reason for saying it, if the writer doesn't feel something deeply, which is normally political really, then it falls flat. And I think that is so, so true. I think writers have something, normally one or two things, like whatever genre you're writing in, that are incredibly important to you. And that's sort of almost what spurred you into wanting to write. So I think that feeling goes through all your novels. You know, I certainly know I'm sort of rethinking the same ideas a lot. But that said, you obviously can't write the same book again and again. So it's really important that you obviously are, you know, make a completely different story around it. And also obviously all our ideas evolve, you know, even though I might be concerned with the same thing as I was when I started writing like 13 years ago, I obviously things have changed in the world and things have changed in my mind and I've resolved things. And I think sometimes when you read like a body, you know, it's like if you think of writers who have, you know, you can read all their books or something, that you can see, like, it's almost like a conversation they've been having with themselves through the course of their career. And I feel like that is always true. I think it's really hard as well to make yourself think, oh, I'm going to write about this because I know it's zeitgeisty, you know. I think it's more that we just have to follow what we are thinking about, really.
Save big money on plant protection supplies now at Menards. Defend your garden with Triazicide Insect Killer. Its fast-acting formula protects lawns, vegetables, and many other plants. It kills more than 260 insects by contact, above and below ground. Choose from ready to spray, concentrate, or granular. Save big money on Triazicide Insect Killer at Menards. And check out our weekly flyer on Menards.com for all the great deals happening now. Save big money
at Menards. Yeah. So your theme, presumably throughout your kind of books, as you mentioned, is mostly gender politics, but you're obviously telling different stories around that.
Yes. And yeah. And obviously my ideas about it have changed. Like, I think I wrote, I think it was 3 books ago, I had a novel called Our Kind of Cruelty. And that was, you know, in a way, that's probably my most similar in theme novel to One of the Good Guys. But actually what I've thought about, like in Our Kind of Cruelty, I was very much thinking about how women's voices are often silenced and we're not really listened to. And also I was thinking about how hard it is to be taken seriously as a woman. And those are all themes that I'm thinking about in One of the Good Guys, but also I now have the added thoughts about Me Too and what that's done to the discourse. And so it's definitely an evolved series of ideas in this one. And obviously a completely and utterly different story.
Yeah. And also, I think when we're talking about theme and things, you know, like you said, Gillian Flynn says that every thriller needs a theme. But at the same time, you don't want that theme to necessarily feel like there's like a strong message that you're hitting the reader over the head with.
Oh, completely, like, it is not, no.
At its core a thriller, like an exciting kind of thriller, like who done it, why done it kind of thing.
Absolutely. And I mean, the best thrillers, I think, or any books in fact, are ones that you only really work out what the writer was saying at the end. You know, you don't want to have written a polemic of sort of, you know, I mean, I think actually Jonathan Franzen, who writes, you know, obviously amazing literary fiction, he, you know, in The Corrections, I only really figured out what he was writing at the end of the novel. And I loved that novel so much. But by the time he had got to Freedom, I felt a little bit like, okay, you know, there were whole passages about climate change that were incredible. I agreed with them, but I sort of felt like, oh, we don't need them. And I think you do have to be really careful. I think you have to obviously let your story do everything. But yeah, I mean, it's obviously a hard balancing act.
Yeah, it is. And I'd love to talk, you've mentioned, you know, we talked about gender politics quite a bit. I'd love to dial it back to before you, I think it was it before you published your first novel in 2011?
Yeah.
Did you work in journalism?
Yes, that's right. Yeah, I worked in journalism for years before that.
What kind of journalism was it?
I did, I started out on women's magazines at a time when, I don't know if you're probably too young, but like a magazine's like Just 17 and, you know, for teenagers actually. And then I moved into like women's, you know, like all those sort of, you know, big like glossy magazines. I mean, they barely exist anymore apart from like Vogue, or, you know, it's the only one that sort of survived. And then I went into newspapers and I ended up on The Mirror actually. But I always did features. I was never a news journalist. So,
right. Okay. Because I'm just wondering, women's magazines and then something like The Mirror, and it's like you were saying, things are different now than they used to be. But if you go back to like the 90s and look at the way that like media treated women,
God, yeah,
or like even just the women's magazines, which were just like full, not that they're not mostly consumerism now, but those kinds of things, did that have like a big influence on what has kind of become your discussions?
Oh, massively. I mean, my first novel, the protagonist is, she works for women's magazines and she is very jaded about it. I mean, I was really aware at the time, I have to say. I mean, it was not a revelation to me that something terrible was going on, you know, because I was privy to all the editorial meetings where, you know, the way women were talked about was not good, even though you were in a room full of women normally. And I was privy to all the touch-up of photographs. You know, it felt, even then in the 90s, I was a young woman, you know, I was in my early 20s, and I knew what we were doing was wrong. And it left a really horrible taste in my mouth a lot of the time. I do think that magazines have changed a lot now. I mean, I think magazines like Grazia have really switched the dial in that they gave women Grazia is amazing in that it will have like a really hard-hitting political feature next to a feature about you know, the best 10 coats to buy for winter or something. And that's true of most, you know, most people are, you know, multidimensional and want to think about lots of different things. And also, I think there has been a real move recently in the last few years towards representing, you know, different types of women and different body shapes and different ethnicities. I mean, you know, it's crazy when you look back the women's magazines of the 80s and 90s, because it feels like it was just like if you were an alien and you came down to Earth, you'd think all women looked one way and only yeah. thought about you know, men and what they looked like. And it's sort yeah. of, and I do think things have come. I mean, I think that's why so many women's magazines like died, because they, you know, they just weren't speaking to women. So I think that has changed a lot. But yeah, I'm not proud of my part in that.
but obviously it was very informative in what kind of inspired some of your later novels. And I'd love to know at what point you started writing novels. Was it while you were doing that, working in journalism? Was it after, or was it before?
Oh no, it's just sort of just been always. I mean, it was always, just okay. that's what I've always wanted to do. But obviously it's, you know, when you leave university, you have to pay the rent. And journalism seemed like the sort of, you know, logical thing to do to me, because, you know, I sort of couldn't think of anything else I could do to get paid other than write things. And so obviously that was sort of the way. But yeah, I mean, I was just writing my novels all the way through. And then yeah, I did an MA actually in creative writing in 2009, I think, or 10, I can't remember. And it must have been 9. And that was really sort of, that was just really incredibly helpful, because it helped me to sort of really hone how to write, but it also really like practically helped with like how you approach it and who to approach and all those sorts of things. So yeah, it was just sort of a question of just keeping on going and right, lots of rejection before it happened.
as is most often the way.
Yeah.
So how many, if you can remember, how many novels or like full manuscripts did you write before?
Oh my goodness.
Was it Everything or Nothing was your
Everything
debut,
and
right?
Nothing is my first. Mm. I mean, loads. I can't remember exactly, because I mean, I really was genuinely writing books from really, really young. So, you know, there will be plenty of books that never, you know, that literally just remained in my bottom drawer for, yeah. you know, forever. And then, in fact, my second novel was actually the first novel that I ever wrote. But I sort of, when I went, it was the novel I got onto my MA with, and it was the novel that I worked on all through my MA. And I sort of realized that it wasn't at all commercial. It's probably my least commercial novel, my second one. And I sort of just realized that I was going to have to do something different. And so I sort of started again. That's when I wrote Everything and Nothing. So, I mean, just so many. I definitely wouldn't know how many.
That's good. I mean, I definitely subscribe to the idea that one of the best ways to learn how to write a novel is just to write a novel.
Yeah. And I think that stays true. I mean, I mean, it's not just however many novels that haven't seen the light of day, but I mean, each novel that has been published of mine, I have so many drafts sitting on computers or, you know, or in drawers again. I mean, I honestly, I write each book so many times. So, and I do, I think that is the only way you get to write, basically, or you get to produce something finished, is just to plow on through until you start making it make sense.
Yeah. It's easy when you're like in a bookshop or just thinking about how talented your favorite authors are to forget that the thing that you're reading is probably the like 10th, 15th, 20th iteration of that
thing
they did with other people. And
completely. I mean, that's the thing. It's like before I show my agent anything, who's my first port of call, I've probably gone through 3 drafts myself. And then her and I will go through a couple of drafts before it goes out to my editor. Or, you know, if you go on submission, it's going to a wide pool of editors. So, and then whoever buys your book, you'll go through a couple of drafts with them as well. So, and then of course you get into things like copy editing and everything, which is where you're fine tuning. So, I mean, yeah, it's an incredibly collaborative, long-winded process.
And every book has gone through probably at least 10 drafts before.
I would say around that. And sometimes the drafts can be, you know, you don't have to literally start again each time.
Yeah.
That would be terrifying. But I mean, between draft 1 and 2, I do pretty much start again. You know, my first draft for me is like the place where I figure out exactly what I want to do and figure out the story. And then it's only after I've written a first draft that I will write. And when I say plan, I mean, it's not a proper plan, but like I will be able to structure the story then. And then I do start again. But from the second draft on, I would hope not to literally start again. I would hope to just be able to sort of, you know, to play with basically what I have. But, you know, I mean, sometimes that involves cutting out chunks of story or moving it around or whatever. But yeah, sort of like you hopefully are slightly there by then.
That's interesting. So you actually, your second draft is actually basically a full rewrite. You're not editing the document from the original one.
No, I find it sort of easier just to, I mean, it's just, I just think I have a very, I have an uneconomical process basically in that I know what I want to say. I know basically what my story is. I know who my characters are, but I can't do that sort of deep dive thing that I know real plotters can do. Like I've got some friends who like they do all that in a plotting way. So they will, you know, they will plot their story out and that's where they find out. And my brain for some reason doesn't work like that. So I have to write the story out. My first draft is basically an extended plan of my book. And then I sort of know what I'm doing and can start.
Is it quite a lot shorter though, that kind of first draft? It's not going to be full,
I mean, sometimes it can be longer. I mean, it's just weird. I know, it's just weird. It's a really, I would love to write in a different way and I can't, but then I also know lots of writers who do that as well, so I feel like I mean, the thing is any way that you write a book is valid. There's no sort of right or wrong, so it's you just have to, I think you just have to accept what you do and go with it basically.
I mean, I've had an author on this podcast who does the in quotes vomit draft by hand, like literally with a pen on paper.
She always wanted
to do that.
Yeah.
And then types it up.
That's amazing. Yeah. I mean, I do know people who do that. And I think there is something to be said for like when I edit, like when I get to like my third draft or something or whatever, I'm editing, I print it out and I make all my notes by hand on the page. And I do, there is something about changing how you do something or even changing what you're looking at that makes a difference, I think. Like I see different things on screen that I see on the printed page. I think it's really important to read your novel in both ways before you submit anything.
Yeah, I've heard quite a few people do a thing where when they're doing their redraft, probably not their like full major redraft, but their kind of edits, they'll Control A, select all on the manuscript and change the font to quite a different font.
Oh, yeah,
of
course.
And then reread it in a different font.
Yeah. No, I have heard of that, actually. Yes. I haven't done that yet, but yeah.
Yeah. Funny how the human brain works.
I know. A lot of it is just tricking yourself, actually.
Yeah.
Which is, not great.
Yeah. Amazing. Well, that's really cool. It's really interesting to hear about your process and things like that. And that does bring us to what is always the final question of every episode, which is, Araminta, if you were stranded on a desert island with a single book, which book do you hope that it would be?
Well, I know, because I knew you were going to ask me this question. So I thought about it, and I'm torn between like a comfort, like my all time favorite novel, I think, is Rebecca by Daphne du Maurier, because it's just like a, to me, and I think if it was published today, it would be published as a thriller. I mean, it definitely would be published as a thriller. You know, I mean, it's like there's no doubt about it, you know, that reveal when she comes down in the dress and everything. I think that, but I am, in fact, there are many reveals in Rebecca, but I've read it so many times, I feel maybe I should pick War and Peace or something, which I've never read. And it will take, hopefully until I'm rescued, because that would be my big aim if I was stranded on a desert island, to be rescued. So I think I'll go for War and Peace.
Yeah, just the biggest book you can find.
Yeah, exactly, that will just keep me occupied.
Yeah, I mean, a great choice and a classic.
Yes, exactly.
I'm forever trying to get myself to read more classics, because every time I do, I'm blown away by how good they
are. Well, exactly. But yeah, War and Peace is one of those books that is sat on my shelf forever and I haven't actually read it, which is shocking. But yeah, it's sort of, yeah, I feel like you could probably reread it about three times, one after the other, and it would be okay. So I think it would keep you going for quite a few months, basically.
Yeah. Yeah, you'd hope so.
Yeah.
With that many pages, it's got to, right?
Exactly.
Amazing. Well, a great choice. Great to have another classic on the desert island. Thank you so much, Araminta, for coming on the podcast and telling us all about your latest book, One of the Good Guys, which is out right now, as well as your writing process and kind of your journey through and into publishing. It's been really cool chatting with you.
Thank you. Thanks for having me on.
And for anyone listening, if you want to keep up with what Araminta is doing, you can follow her on Twitter and Instagram at Araminta Hall. And to make sure you don't miss an episode of this podcast, follow along on Twitter, Instagram, TikTok, and Facebook. You can listen to the podcast ad-free and a week early on Patreon. And for more bookish chat, check out my other podcast, The Chosen Ones and Other Tropes. Thanks again to Araminta, and thanks to everyone listening. We'll catch you on the next episode.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.